For those of you who don't know me, as Brian said, my name is Jackie Kelly. I'm a Unitarian Universalist minister and a member of this congregation. And I'm very happy to be with you today. Last month, I discovered that I have house guests. Cute little furry unwanted house guests in my heating ducts and crawl space and perhaps elsewhere. The jury is still out on that. This is not the first time that squirrels have entered and died in hidden places in my home. But it is the first time that no one has been able to detect where they are getting in or how much damage they may be doing. This distresses me. I have become hypervigilant to every creak and rustle and pop. And my house has plenty of those even without the squirrels. I feel invaded. I feel suspicious of every little furry-tailed creature scurrying through the tree branches in my backyard. "Where are you getting in?" I ask. They look at me defiantly and jump onto my roof. The squirrels, I fear, are inside tearing up the place. Flannery O'Connor was an amazing writer of short stories that brought together the sacred and the profane in ways that were both grotesque and filled with grace. Perhaps the same could be said of her life. She suffered from the devastating disease lupus and died far too young, as did her father before her. Lupus is a chronic inflammatory disease that occurs when your body's immune system attacks your own tissues and organs. Inflammation caused by lupus can affect many different body systems, including your joints, skin, kidneys, blood cells, brain, heart, and lungs. Lupus is the Latin word for wolf. The wolf, I fear, is inside tearing up the place. It seems insensitive somehow to compare a few squirrels to a devastating disease like lupus. And yet, maybe not. About 12 years ago, I cracked a molar and had to get a crown. Now, in addition to my squirrel problem, I also broke my crown last month and had to go to my dentist to have the old crown removed, the remains of the original tooth ground down and cleaned up, and a temporary crown put on while awaiting the permanent one. Afterward, the pain in my tooth grew more and more agonizing each day, until my dentist determined that the poor old tooth had been so traumatized that it needed to be put out of its misery with a root canal. You cannot imagine the number of horror stories I heard about other people's ghastly experiences with root canals. Being a real wuss about anything having to do with people putting their hands in my mouth and drilling holes in my teeth, let alone sticking sharp pointy things into my roots, I read up on root canals and decided to trust the dental websites that indicated that they were relatively painless and recovery was about the same as recovering from a filling. Well, the first part of that proved to be true. With the help of Novocaine, nitrous oxide, and a bit of music, getting the root canal was relatively trauma-free. The bit about recovery? A week after the procedure, the pain and sensitivity were still making my life miserable. My imagination leapt to worst-case scenarios. The dentist missed a root. My tooth is fractured. There's a horrible infection raging beneath my tooth. I'm going to have to do this again. No, I'm going to have the tooth yanked out. The tooth, I feared, was inside tearing up the place. I have a friend who's getting chemotherapy treatments for leukemia, after which she will receive a stem cell transplant. She has just finished her second of six rounds, and at the end of her first round, she was suffering so greatly from the side effects of the treatment that she seriously questioned whether it was worth it to continue. The cancer, as well as its treatment, she feared, were inside tearing up the place. My friend's illness and suffering are much greater than the problems I've had with my tooth. But is it helpful to compare? I suppose, in a way, it may put suffering in perspective. To calm myself, when my imagination was feeding me horror stories, I reflected on how fortunate I am to live in a time and place where technology is so advanced that I felt no pain during my root canal, and even if something had gone wrong, it could ultimately be fixed. At the same time, I decided not to deride myself for my wussiness. I chose to respect my feelings. I felt my fear. I experienced my suffering, and I did not shame myself for feeling as I did. By balancing my thoughts about ultimately being in good hands with my feelings of fear and worry, I was able to develop a relationship with my suffering and experience the reality of it. My friend has also had to form a relationship with her suffering. She experienced despair, and she contemplated that experience. Again, a balance between feeling and thinking. One day she had a panic attack and was struggling to breathe. In her despair, she told me, she tried to not breathe, but she couldn't do it. And she realized then that her desire to live was greater than the desire to be free of her suffering. She doesn't know what will happen. She cannot control whether she lives or dies. She says, "I have a shot." She is in relationship with both the precariousness and the preciousness of her life. She is in relationship with her suffering. I cannot compare my suffering with hers. Everyone's suffering is their own. Suffering is unique to each person within her or his own story. Suffering sucks. We try to make sense of it. There are many theories about what causes suffering, why it exists, what meaning we can derive from it. My mother was ill during most of my young childhood, and she died when I was 12. She suffered a lot, and so did I. And so did the rest of my family. As a girl in my early teens, I tried to make meaning of this from my faith perspective. The question of where God is in the midst of suffering is known as theodicy. If God is all powerful and all good, why is there suffering? Some say it teaches us compassion. Some say it is because we are too attached to our own desires. Some say it is because Adam and Eve ate the forbidden fruit. Some say we can offer it up to God for the sake of others. None of those beliefs really did much for me as a teenager. Then I found a little book by Rabbi Harold Kushner called When Bad Things Happen to Good People. And at the time, it helped me greatly because it presented me with a new way of believing that the power of God is the power to be with rather than the power to control what happens. This was a theory of theodicy that worked for me in my suffering. However, when I became a chaplain resident at a hospital in San Francisco, I encountered a woman on the oncology unit whose son was dying of cancer. Sitting at his bedside, she asked me, "How can God allow this to happen?" So I offered her this theory that had so helped me, and she shouted angrily at me, "You have no idea what I'm going through." I felt terrible. I apologized, ended the visit quickly, and left the room. But out in the hallway, I knew I hadn't ministered to this woman, and I had quite possibly done more harm than good. So, with great fear and anxiety, I turned around and went back in the room. I said, "You're right. I don't have any idea what this is like for you. Can you tell me?" And she did. And it was a powerful moment for me, and I hope for her. Student chaplains learn by doing. They learn how to minister through the people to whom they minister. I learned from this woman that people need to give voice to their suffering. We need someone to hear and experience our anger and grief and fear. We need relationship. We do not need answers or advice or theories. Now I am an educator of student chaplains in the clinical pastoral education program at St. Luke's. During their first unit of CPE, I asked the residents to write their statements of ministry and theodicy. Then again, at the end of their year-long residency, I asked them to write it again. At the beginning, they often have a theodicy that sounds like something they might have learned in seminary, intellectual and filled with certainty. At the end, they often write something more like, "I don't know how to explain suffering," or, "There seems to be no answer to the question of theodicy. All I can do is be present to others in their suffering." That is true learning in the world of spiritual care, going from certainty to wondering, from knowing we have the answer that fits all people to listening for what suffering means to someone else. In a month and a half, I will have 8 new students. In our first days together, we will each spend an hour telling the group the stories of our lives. Perhaps somebody will say, "I had a perfectly normal childhood. My parents were wonderful. I married a wonderful spouse, and we have 2 wonderful children." Then, later in the unit, when they feel more confident of the group and the process, they may mention that their uncle sexually abused them, or their mother was mentally ill, or their spouse is an alcoholic. It is hard for many of us to speak of or even recognize the ways in which we suffer. With CPE students, and with many people who value service to others. This often has something to do with the belief that we should focus on the suffering of others and our own suffering should be ignored. It seems selfish somehow to think about and allow ourselves to feel the ways in which we have suffered or are currently suffering, especially when there are others right in front of us who are in need. Actually, though, I think the issue is more that we don't want to realize how little control any of us have over tragedy. As one of my students said, I thought I was in a different boat than the people I ministered to. They were in the broken boat, and I was in the whole boat. Now I understand that we're all in the same boat, and it's the broken one. As Leslie and Carrie expressed so beautifully in the interlude, everybody hurts. In CPE, people learn that providing spiritual care requires tremendous vulnerability so that we can recognize suffering and be present with it without giving in to the impulse to fix it, to make it pretty and clean, or to run away from it. We become intimately familiar with our own suffering so that we can be with others in theirs. Understanding that we are ultimately not so different from one another, even though the ways in which we hurt or suffer may be quite different, provides us with the power of humility. I first attempted to minister to the woman with the dying son with an attitude of, "Oh, you poor thing. Let me make you feel better. I know just what you need." I learned humility. That mother taught me to approach her with curiosity and compassion so that I might learn about her suffering and what it meant to her. The word compassion means to suffer with. At this time of the year, it has a particular meaning for Jews and Christians. Passover begins on Tuesday, commemorating a time of great suffering for the Jewish people, followed by a celebration of freedom from slavery. In the Christian church, today is Palm Sunday, also known as Passion Sunday, which begins the observance of Jesus' last week on earth. There are plenty of people who celebrate Palm Sunday with palm branches and hosannas and happy hymns, and then come back to church the next Sunday to celebrate the resurrection of Jesus and sing more happy hymns. It's actually the part in between where the passion is. That's not the part most people like. I imagine it was not the part Jesus liked either. But there you have it. Everybody hurts. Everybody suffers. Whether we try to pretend we don't or not, we still don't get to leave out the bad parts. And there is an opportunity there. There is an opportunity to draw close, to be in relationship in a powerful way, as people who are all in the same boat. It's not a bad boat. It's actually a pretty good boat, but sometimes it hits the rocks and starts to sink, and then we need to help each other keep it afloat. There's a story in the Bible in the book of Mark about Jesus walking across the sea during a windstorm and getting into the boat where his terrified disciples were struggling with the waves. I think they were more terrified that he was walking on the water than that their boat was in danger of capsizing. But my point is that he got into the boat with them. I would even say that Jesus got in the boat, metaphorically speaking, to help us see that the divine is within each of us, to help us know and feel that we are not alone. I believe the only possible healing in suffering is through relationship. When I'm suffering and fearful of the unknown, I feel alone. I do think it's true that suffering can only be done by the one who is experiencing it. Flannery O'Connor once said, "Sickness is a place more instructive than a long trip to Europe, a place where there is no company." Yet, isolation augments suffering. When chaplains visit patients in the hospital, they ask them where they find support, how they are coping with their illness or injury. Almost all of them answer that question in relational terms. My family, my friends, my dog, God, prayer, music, nature. All of these reflect relationship with self, between self and others, and or between self and the transcendent. We human beings know many things. We have developed technology that can heal and cure. But we cannot control many aspects of tragedy and suffering. The wolf, the squirrels, the cancer, the crucifixion will still get inside and tear up the place. And we will have to bear that awful fear of the unknown and of being out of control. But we don't have to bear it alone. I cannot experience what it is like for my friend to have leukemia, but I can hear her as she tells me what it is like for her. I can hold her hand and let the spirit of the holy pass between us. And together, perhaps, we can experience a moment, however brief, of healing.
Take courage, friends. The way is often hard, the path is never clear, and the stakes are very high. For deep down, there is another truth. You are not alone. Go in peace.